Okay. This is May 26, 2010. My name is Jessica Lancha. I'm interviewing Meryl Mushroom. Mm-hmm. We are at the Women Rights Conference in Georgia. And Meryl, would you state your date of birth for the record?
My date of birth is November 13th, 1941.
Awesome. Okay, so I guess since we're at Woman Rights, maybe a first good question would be to talk about how you got started with it, how this all came about.
Well, it all came about because there were a group of lesbians in Atlanta who were forming ALFA, the Atlanta Lesbian Feminist Alliance, and some were writers, and we're talking about starting a lesbian writers conference. And they managed to get it together and found a place, which was here. And I think there were about 30 to 35 women at the first Woman Rights, which I was not at, but I've been at every one since. And it's persisted. It's a wonderful experience because there's nobody in charge. And it takes its shape from one year to the next, and it alters itself and changes according to the needs of the women who are involved, and has expanded so that usually there are somewhere in the vicinity of 100 women who come in the spring. Started out as a long weekend, Thursday through Sunday, and then went Wednesday through Sunday, and then became an entire week, with 3 days at the beginning, kind of as a pre-conference gathering, which was not quite as structured. And then people decided that they couldn't go a whole year without getting together, so we started one in the fall as well, which is a long weekend in the fall. And that's where it is at now. We've had issues, we've gone through all kinds of trips and tribulations with each other. We dealt with racism for several years as an issue, and with SM for several years as an issue, and never did have an issue about the transgender, which people thought would probably be the next issue, but it just never became an issue, which I think is really nice and kind of a testimonial to the way that we were able to work things out so well among and between each other.
What were the SM and racism issues?
The racism issue was there were a group of women who were really, really involved in anti-racism work, and there were a couple of women who were not involved whatsoever in any kind of anti-racism work. And those women felt that we should have a writers' conference and that working on racism was not a part of that. And other women thought that working on racism was an integral part of that. And there was a commitment to try to include women of color, which in my opinion verged on trying to go out and find them and force them so we could show that we were being inclusive. And there was a lot of hassling around about it for many, many, many years. Well, how do we include women of color, and should we include women of color? And if you include women of color, you have to create a safe space so that they'll want to come. And at the time, there was a lot more separation because women of color needed their own space to do more self-definition and find their own power. And coming to a white women's conference so that they could be a black presence was not fair. Right. But at the same time, we felt that something was missing, which of course it was. And then there were women who felt that when you're speaking about diversity, there is more than just race issues that are involved, that you have age issues, and that women of color are not the only non-Caucasian women that there are, and some of the Latino women who are feeling marginalized. And there were no Native American women and the Polynesian women, and, you know, after a while you have to kind of find a point of balance with all of that. So I think mainly the way we resolved it was to try to include as much as possible workshops on around issues of racism, working on our racism and trying to find a point of equilibrium, and who had a very, very bad year where there was an incident where there were quite a few women of color here, and some of the local neighborhood boys tried to come in over the gate, and they were black teenage kids, and one of the women who had a really bad history of abuse kind of freaked out and blew the whistle, and women went running and screaming, and she was telling her story and said that they had said something about a white bitch, and as soon as the word white was mentioned, one of the women of color rose up in all her rage and fury, and there was total and complete divisiveness, and people were going after women to accuse them, and it was really, really, really unpleasant. People circled, and the circle was not handled well, and people were yelling at one another, and it was probably the high point of awfulness in the history of human rights that I can recall.
What year was that?
Ew. Boy, I don't know. It was a long time ago. It was maybe 20 years ago or thereabouts. I don't know. I could probably pinpoint it if I talked to some people and look back through some materials.
Yeah.
And some people may even remember, but it was very, very, very unpleasant. And the women that were directly involved ended up leaving, and then we came back together again and worked on our issues some more and processed and reprocessed, and I think came to a point where we just set things aside and let them heal and be what they were and come to a point of stability as things were, if you were there long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think most of the people here are pretty well committed to racism, anti-racism work as being a necessary kind of thing, but it's not done with such fervor and such isolationism as it was. It's a different generation of people, and I think people are a lot more easy with one another. The SM issue was that women were walking around on the premises displaying the accoutrements and whips and handcuffs and stuff like that, and other women were being triggered and getting a little crazed by it, and that worked out a whole lot better, although it did take a couple of years of processing to work it through. But we came together several times in a group, and the commitment of everybody here was to work things out so that nobody felt silenced and nobody was triggered, and it was all done from a point of caring about one another and not a point of political correctness, which I think that had a lot to do with the racism issues. Oh, and there was another incident where a woman had come who was heterosexual and was talking about her husband, and she'd written a book, and some people didn't like her to begin with, and she read a portion of her book where a black woman was enticing a white woman, and she used the phrase jungle eyes, and one of the other women who was an anti-racism activist back from the old days flew off the handle and publicly embarrassed her and accused her, and then she had the ignorance to turn to one of the black women and ask for a defense, and it didn't really turn into as explosive a situation as the other one. Actually, it happened before that. It was several years before that happened, but it was mean and it was unpleasant and it was not resolved. And that woman, who was kind of on the burning pyre there, didn't come back for about 15 years. She eventually did come back and had learned better manners herself by then. And things have settled down here a whole lot. But the SM issue went smoothly, considering, and that's how we started out with the Loud and Rowdy cabin down by the lake, where people could have their scenes and be as loud as they wanted and not so much bother other people. And every once in a while, somebody will forget and come up and be obvious and somebody else will get frightened, and we'll just work it out on the spot because we have mediators and facilitators now who volunteer to be available at all times. So if any women are having any kind of problems or conflicts or periods of uncomfortableness, they can go to the mediators who will work with her and the other person if that's what's called for, and help work things through before they come to a crisis point.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen very often, and it's good to have it around when it does happen. And most of the time it happens, it's around misunderstandings about policies or procedures at the campsite or personal relationship kinds of things.
How did the trans issue play out? When did that...
Well, some of the women were becoming boys, and some of the other women thought that maybe this would be the next issue, like it is in Michigan. But will we or will we not allow? And it was just commonly accepted, not even decided, but accepted that, you know, Rebuild is a Southern Lesbian Conference. And if you identify as a Southern lesbian, then you come to the conference. And if you don't identify as either, then you either have the respect not to come or come and pass.
Right.
We've had a male to female person here, and I never even knew that this person was not a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because people aren't here to create an issue. People are here to write and relax with one another and feel safe with one another, and being safe is such a big part of it. Women don't criticize each other, we don't jump on each other, we're not mean to each other. It's primarily geared towards women being able to write, relax, and feel safe, and feel free, and feel able to do what they need to do in safety. And it works. I can go with this.
Yeah, you've been coming back for how many years now?
32.
So you're one of the founders, then.
Not really. I didn't come the first year. I talked about it some, but I wouldn't be considered, I don't think, a founder, because I didn't do it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see how it went the first time. I knew about it the first time, and I think maybe I had to still work and couldn't get off.
So how would you explain... Okay, Mike, do you first of all consider yourself to be a lesbian feminist activist?
Yeah, you bet.
All right, good. How did you come to that path? How did that identity happen?
Well, I was always a lesbian, and things were not good in the 50s when I was coming out.
That was not nice.
And then I went through the Johns investigations at the University of Florida, and that was even more unpleasant. And then I was really good friends with Julia Penelope, and back at the time, Julia was doing a lot of writing on language and how language is used to control people and how very subtle uses of language can manipulate and cause people to think in certain ways that they're not even aware of. And she really raised my awareness about how language, you know, like how... Well, for example, the use of the word got, you know, when you say a woman got raped, it puts her, it blames her. Well, she got raped, so she must have done something. And the nominative passive where the corporation laid off all these people, and it wasn't a corporation, it was a person that did it. And she was into naming responsible parties and making them take public responsibility for the actions that they did, and being very specific about what was going on. And I learned how sexist the language is, how the generic is not generic. The generic male pronoun really refers to men, even though it supposedly includes women, but it doesn't. And even generic nouns, professors. So there, and she pulled a lot of examples from literature and publications. We're having a meeting tonight for professors and their wives. which of course presupposes that all professors be male. And she went, Julie was invited one night by a fellow professor to smoke in the study after dinner, and she said, well, why would I want to do that? And he said, because that's what the men do. And I started seeing it everywhere. I started seeing sexism in the language and racism in the language and oppressive language everywhere. And it kind of really ruined my enjoyment of a lot of movies and songs, because there it was. You know, just blatant misuse of language that most people thought was just fine and there was nothing wrong with it. And it kind of went on from there, you know, brought into include not only language but actions and the way the whole political system was set up. And then I started working with poor people, and I moved to a rural area and started working with people in the rural area and saw how left out so many people were from the general consciousness of people who were in power, who called the shots. And I guess that's about where it started, and it's snowballed since.
So were you part of any organizations or groups during this period?
Let's see, when I lived in New York, I worked with another Mother for Peace organization, even though I wasn't a mother at the time, and mostly what I did at the time was to counsel guys on how to get out of the draft by saying that they were gay, even if they weren't, and how to work. And that was nice.
And you taught them how to pass as gay?
Yeah, how to, you know, what to do, because, you know, guys would dress up, you know, like flamboyantly and go and be really outrageous, and then nobody would believe them. They'd say, oh, you're just trying to draft dodge. So we would work on how to go in very seriously and ask to see the psychiatrist first when you went in, and when you saw the psychiatrist, you told the psychiatrist that you were homosexual and that this would not be a good placement for you because you'd be exposed to so much temptation and you'd probably get kicked out, and so they would be classified 4F, and which was undesirable, I guess, for military service. Most of the time it was because of physical ailments, but also because of psychological ailments. And they would not be on the draft list.
So what years was this?
This was in the 60s.
Vietnam War era.
Yeah, yeah. When they were drafting like crazy. And if they were willing to do that, then it didn't follow them anywhere, and it didn't keep them from getting jobs, and it didn't ruin their lives. It just kept them out of the service.
So in the 60s in New York, was that before or after University of Florida?
After. So I graduated from University of Florida in 1962 and lived for a year in Gadsden, Alabama, and as a kind of a baby civil rights activist, helped with integrating the library and watched the Freedom Bus come through on its way to Anniston to get turned over, and did minor peripheral work with some of the civil rights activists in Gadsden. And then I moved to New York and was a bar dyke for a while in New York. I was a bar dyke in Florida before I left Florida.
Define bar dyke.
Say?
Define bar dyke.
Bar dyke is a dyke that hangs out at the bars. And I did a lot of writing about being a bar dyke in Florida in the 50s. It was not a great place to be queer because it was against the law, and people could be arrested and imprisoned and put into mental hospitals against their will just for being a homosexual or a lesbian.
Were you ever?
No, it was not. But Marcia, who just came in and went out, was. She was a buddy of mine in New York and in Florida in the 50s when I was coming out. She was coming out. And I knew a lot of women that were picked up by the police, and the police knew who all the dykes were, and sometimes if a lesbian was caught in a compromising position, the officer of the law would demand a blowjob in order to let her go, or beat her up, or whatever, and there were a lot of raids on the bars, and people were pulled in, and people's names were published in the newspapers, and lives were ruined and suicides were committed and families were wrecked. And then when Charlie John started his purges, his McCarthy-esque purges, things got even worse. And when I left Florida in 62, things were not a whole lot better. I think maybe when the DSM declassified homosexuality as being a mental illness, things changed a little bit.
That was in 74,
72? Yeah, I don't know.
That was in the 70s.
But I know that you could be arrested. You had to have 3 articles of sex-appropriate clothing on your body when you were arrested, or else you could be put in jail and charged. And the charges in Florida at the time were crime against nature. If you were caught in any kind of a real compromising position, consensual position, if you didn't have 3 articles of sex-appropriate clothing on, they would charge you with vagrancy. They had like 27 counts of vagrancy they could charge a person with if they were picked up with, had a job, had money in their pocket, had a family, were well-dressed, they could still be charged with vagrancy and held at least 24 hours on suspicion. And then, of course, everything went in the newspaper.
So in spite of all of these very negative repercussions for being out, you were still out.
Yeah, I was a kid. You know, I was underage. I was 16, 17, 18, 19. I was immortal. Nobody was going to touch me. You know, my friends, we bounced back again. The biggest fear was that our parents should find out or we would get kicked out of school.
Where were you in high school?
I was at Miami Beach High.
So from Miami, you moved to Gainesville.
Miami Beach.
Miami Beach, you moved to Gainesville.
To Gainesville to go to school. And there was a gay beach. There was a really big gay community at the time in Miami Beach. So there was lots of support, which really was helpful. The people that worked the bars knew who was underage, but if we had proper ID, then they'd let us in, unless they were expecting a police raid. And then they'd tell us that we couldn't come.
How did you first find out in Miami Beach about this place that you could go and meet people like you?
Everybody knew about it. It was like pretty common knowledge. You know, there were queers, there were homos. Homos on the beach, 21st Street Beach, which was the gay beach, was just like kind of common knowledge. There was a gay group in high school. Where I went to high school, kids were
coming. A gay group?
Yeah. Yeah, we had a gay group. Kids were coming out and going to the bars underage and going to the gay beach. And the police would raid the gay beach and they would pull people off the beach and charge them with vagrancy just to be mean. Pack them into the paddy wagons, cart them off to jail, just for going to the beach.
Yeah. And then in Florida, what was the scene like when you, I guess you were 18 by then?
Yeah, that was Florida. That was the scene.
Oh, sorry, in Gainesville.
In Gainesville, it was a whole lot more secretive. We were closeted anyway. We were open with each other, but we were closeted in general. Because you could lose your job. You could be put in jail or put in a mental hospital. It was dangerous. In Gainesville, you could get kicked out of school. And when the Johns investigation started, it was even more dangerous. So we were pretty secretive and pretty quiet. We knew who each other was. We found out who each other was. We went to Tampa a lot, to the gay bars in Tampa, because it was close enough to get to, but far enough away to not be discovered.
There wasn't a gay bar in Gainesville?
Oh, no, there weren't any bars. It was dry county.
Really?
Two beers, you could get it. 2 places, 2 beer joints. And that was the end of the alcohol.
So did you just meet among friends in your houses, or how did...
Well, we'd go to Tampa, we'd meet in our rooms. You know, you'd see somebody and think, oh, you know, that looks like a lesbian. And so you'd get in a conversation and signal. And there were how you crossed your legs. You looked at how you crossed your legs, which was an indication if it was ankle over knee. If you held your cigarette way down in the crotch of your fingers, it could be an indication. If you wore a pinky ring, it was a dead giveaway. language that you use? Did you say Mercy or Mary or any little gay innuendo? So there are all these little signals we could send each other.
Secret language.
Yeah, yeah. And then it was, you know, kind of a matter of either the person that we were trying to come across to would definitely avoid us and want nothing to do with us, so we knew for sure they were gay and scared, or we would become friends.
And how did the issue of language that your friend was talking about, Julia Penelope, how did that play into, I'm guessing at the time you said you called yourselves or each other homos?
Yeah, homos.
Was there specific, was there lesbian, was that a usage? Was
it's a dirty word.
It existed, but
like,
it was an insult.
China. Because he didn't say it at the time. Yeah, it was like really a creepy word. Yeah.
Do you remember when you started using the word and it didn't mean?
Yeah, in New York, when I got to New York and the kind of women's lib came along and Dyke Power. Dyke was a really bad insult in the 50s. Diesel Dyke was even worse than that. We were gay. We were gay guys and gay girls. And that's kind of what we called each other. The people who weren't gay called us homos. We didn't call ourselves homos, we called ourselves gay.
And did you, when you moved to New York, what was this, how, what scene did you enter? There are a variety of different scenes at that point, right?
I went to the gay bars, and I remember very, very clearly my first night in a gay bar in New York, and there was a police raid, and they just cleared the bar and told everybody to just go out of the bar, and I was dumbfounded because in Florida they would put us in the paddy wagon, some holes to the clinker, and in New York they didn't ever do that.
And this was after, this was 64?
63.
62,
63.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was like, oh my God, it was such freedom. You can go to a gay bar, and even though they close the bar, they don't persecute you.
Until Stonewall.
but still they didn't pull people out of the bars and put them in jail.
Right.
They didn't pull them out and put them in mental hospitals just for being gay.
Right. So your New York experience was more open, I guess, liberating in a way.
Yeah, it was somewhat more liberating. It still wasn't really cool because you could be fired for being gay.
Right.
People weren't particularly accepting of it. But then in 64, 65, around there, I got into the psychedelic movement and the underground theater movement, into the gay part of that. So,
what is that?
Well, you had the hippie movement, and you know, the drug heads and the acid freaks, and I was with a huge group of people that were those, but not heterosexual. So it was a gay, but actually it was a mixed bunch. It was some gays and some straights, but typically the hippies were women in the kitchen, men in the fields kind of people. And our group was a queer group, so it was everybody wherever they wanted to be kind of people. And we didn't really mix a whole lot with the others except around the drug experience, you know, where you get your acid and how to find the best psychedelic show place and health food place. And I opened a kind of a head shop with a couple of friends, and we worked with street kids, with runaway kids. It was 66, it was the flower summer, and a lot of kids were running away and coming to the streets of New York, and they were young and they were being abused very often, and they were freaking out from bad drugs very often. So we worked with a lot of the kids through the store that we had, and we had a free food kitchen and some free clothing and not exactly counseling services, but sort of somewhat in the way of referral services.
Was that still targeted towards gay youth, or was that
towards
everyone?
Yeah, the hippie youth.
Anyone who was
in
out
general,
on the street and hippies.
Yeah, of which some were gay, but most were not.
Mm-hmm. What happened in like 67, 68, 69, that sort of the, what historians consider the formative years of the women's liberation movement?
Yeah, and that was also the the demise of the positive part of the hippie movement, because the hippie movement, psychedelia, became commercialized, and once the media and the industries and the corporations saw they could make money off it, they made money off it, and drugs got bad, and the experience itself got bad. And most of the hardcore hippies moved out of the city and went back to the land. And the women's movement came in, feminism took over. I was semi-involved in that at the time because I was still pretty much into the psychedelic movement. And in 71, 72, I left New York. I kind of teamed up with a gay guy that I'd known from the University of Florida, and we used to be dancing partners in the gay bars in Florida, and then I reconnected with him when we moved to New York, and the two of us, I guess, were kind of the focal points of our group of friends, of the hippie movement, of the queers and the gay guys and the lesbians and the heterosexuals that were compatible with this. And it's time to leave New York. We got married. We decided we wanted to adopt kids and go back to the land and find some kind of queer psychedelic community and, you know, do that particular hippie pie in the sky thing that people were leaving the city to do. And we bought a school bus and adopted our first kid and had a dog and left New York to look for where we wanted to buy land. Thought maybe we would settle in New Mexico at the Hog Farm because we knew a lot of people that had moved to the Hog Farm, or maybe Oregon because we knew a lot of people that had moved to Eugene. Maybe Arkansas because Eureka, Fayetteville area, was an area where people were going. And we just traveled around for a year and we didn't like it out west. And we weren't considering the Southeast even though we both had lived there because our first kid was black, and the racial situation when we left Florida was not great. But it seemed that things were changing and they were getting better. And our friend Julia, who originally turned me on with her writing to language, was teaching at the University of Georgia in Athens, and we stayed with her for a while, and she decided she wanted to do community with us. And my cousin, who's a straight man, decided he wanted to do it, and Julia's lover decided she wanted to do it. So we came to Knoxville, where we knew people from the Knoxville Lesbian Feminist Alliance, and figured we'd stop there and get a stable place to live and get jobs and look for land from there. And we checked out Arkansas on the way cross country, and it was a little too isolated for what we needed. So we settled in Knoxville and figured we'd look in the Smokies, we'd look in the Ozarks, we'd look in North Georgia, we'd check out Kentucky, we'd kind of make a big circuit around and see what the land held and what the prices were. And there we were in the Southeast, where we never expected to be. And my cousin Billy was the one that was going to be traveling because we were working, and one day picked up an old copy of Mother Earth News magazine, and there was a letter in it from this couple who had settled in the middle of Tennessee. Saying that they were vegetarians and back to the land people and interested in the Green Revolution, and they were from the Northeast and had bought land here in Tennessee, and land was cheap and the locals were mellow, and they were looking for like-minded people to come and explore the area. So we went out to visit them. They were not far from Knoxville, and she cut the wood and he made the tea, and we liked that right away, and they were real sweet. And then a few months later, their car broke down in Knoxville on their way to the Northeast with several other people who had moved to the area, so we got to know them even better. And they showed my cousin the piece of land that we ended up living on when he went on his circuit looking for land. It was 100 acres. It was $200 an acre. There were two houses on it and two barns. And six springs and a stream of water up the middle, and it was exactly what we had been looking for. 10 miles from town and 60 miles from a big city, and lots of people coming into the area because of that letter and because of the networking. Locals were mellow, the hippies were numerous. Not many gays and lesbians, but we could always go away for that. We were close to Nashville, close to Knoxville, close to Atlanta, close to Louisville, Kentucky, close to Huntsville, close enough to a lot of places. And then there was a piece of land called Short Mountain, which a bunch of anarchists had bought. And one of them came out, and then another one came out. And then over the next couple of years, most of the hardcore anarchists drifted away, and it became a fairy sanctuary, and bunches of gay men moved in. And so now we're kind of on the second generation of kids moving out. The first generation were the hippies, and they had a bunch of kids, and now we've got the generation of queers.
And you're still living in this Knoxville, Short Mountain area.
Yeah, it's not Knoxville. It's DeKalb County, Tennessee. It's about 130 miles from Knoxville west and a little south. And it's about 70 miles from Nashville east and a little south. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful area. And it's a very sparsely populated rural county. The population of the county has not changed since I've been there. And that's about 36 years already. It's poor county, but the land's gorgeous, and there are a lot of queer people there who are into alternative living styles, and it's nice. Allison lives there, the cook, lives down the road, and Ida, which I don't know if you've heard of, is a queer community the other way down the road. Short Mountain's still there, big, big fairy sanctuary. Now they have about 700-800 people at their gatherings that they have four times a year. And Ida has Ida Palooza, which is also a major queer gathering, music festival in the fall. They have several hundred people there. And ended up with five kids adopted across Tennessee. And they're grown now, thank God. And that's that. There it is.
And now what?
Now what is just nothing. Come to Woman Rights to get my dyke dose, and I've got a sweetie who lives in Huntsville that I see, who also has a very full life. We don't live together. We've been together about 20 years. And before that, I was with a woman from the area. We kind of overlapped when we were not being monogamous. And the guy I live with is a radical fairy, and he does a lot of radical fairy stuff, and he's headed out to Rainbow Family Gathering pretty soon, and there's just lots and lots going on. You know, there's gardens, and there's canning, and there's putting food up, and there's developing new ways to live, and there's cutting wood, and stoking the stove, and going away and being with dykes, and yeah, if I had anything to complain about, it would be that I would like more lesbians in the area, but the younger people don't much identify as lesbians anymore. And that's okay. They're great. They're great. And that's that. Well, let's do it.
No, I know. I'd like to ask you about the Johns Committee and about your coming out story, but I know those have been recorded in other places.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to make you retell those stories, but I want to thank you.
Yeah, thank you
so much.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe we can pick it up at a later date.
Sure.
I know.
Sure. Anytime, any place, any more. If you want any supplement about the Johns investigations or any of that.
I'm going to look at the videos.
Yeah, I would like that not to be lost, because that is a terrible blight on the history of Florida, and it was like during the McCarthy investigations, and it was a little mini McCarthy investigation. And when it originally started, when Charlie Johns originally took, the committee itself was set up, the, what was the hell of the committee? was a committee that was set up during the beginning of the civil rights era when there was a lot of violence, and they were supposed to keep an eye on activist organizations, anarchists, communists, integrationists, to try to prevent violence. And there was Senator Henry Hand was the first head of the committee, and he was pretty mellow, but when Charlie Johns took it over, he really fancied himself a John McCarthy Jr., and he decided that the NAACP was a communist front organization, and he was going to get them, and he was going to blow them apart, had them to court, and lost. And when he found that he was not able to intimidate the black people in the Miami area, he decided to pick on someone else. And around that time, there was a gay guy who was murdered by some teenage hustlers in Bayfront Park. And the case became sensational, and it got in all the papers, and all of a sudden everybody became really, really aware of the extent of the gay and lesbian community in Florida, and they were frightened by it because here were all of these perverts and criminals who were going to seduce their children and damage their children. And so Charlie Johns decided that this would be the group he would go after, and he would purge the state of this pestilence. And since there were no civil rights at all for gays and lesbians, and it was not even considered, you know, we were like pretty low-down criminals, he had free rein to do what he wanted. So he set up his investigations with the university. He sent undercover policemen into the bathrooms to encourage gay men and then arrest them, and then forced them to name other people, and they got a whole roster file of names, and then they went after the people on the file of names, and they called people in for interrogations. I mean, like in a movie, you know, sitting over there with the light shining on them and the interrogators behind the light throwing questions at them and verbally abusing them and threatening them with all kinds of stuff.
And you were involved.
I was not interrogated by them. I was interrogated by the detective at the university, but that was a whole other ballgame. But the grapevine was, you know, everybody who was part of the community at all knew through the grapevine that there were going to be hearings, that all of these interviews were going to come to a head eventually, and nobody knew who was on the list unless they'd been called in. And if somebody was called in, they weren't saying whether or not they named anybody, so nobody really knew who had been named and who was going to be busted and, you know, what was going to happen. So people were really, really scared.
But how did it happen that you were named by the detective?
I was gotten by the detective because I had been going to Tampa a whole lot, and when I went to Tampa, I just put on my sign-up card that I was going to stay at a hotel or a motel in Tampa. And I was like 17, and they pulled my card and wanted to know where I got all this money to go to these hotels and motels. And the guy was really hammering at me, and I finally told him that I was going down with my boyfriend and that I was underage, and I didn't want my boyfriend to get in trouble because I was underage, and we stayed with this gay couple down there, and I didn't want to get them in trouble because it was not legal to be gay, but they were giving my boyfriend and myself a place to meet each other, and it was all we had, and we were so in love, and we were going to get married someday, and please don't get my boyfriend in trouble, please don't get these people that were so nice to give us a place to see each other in trouble, and, you know, crying and hysterical and just going all over this boyfriend stuff. And he got real quiet. And he said, oh, so you get along with the gay homos? And then he said, well, if you get along with them so well, maybe you can get in with them here on campus and tell us who they are. Because after all, if you really care about these people, you'll understand that they're very sick people and we just want to get them help. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, now what? So I told him, let me think about it, and it was close to the end of the semester, and I went back and thought about how the hell I was going to get my mother to let me transfer to the University of Miami. And that was what I thought about, and that was what I finally did. I was able to do that and got out of there. in the University of Miami, they would not allow the Johns Committee on campus because it was a private university. They didn't have to. They went to University of Florida, they went to Florida State, and then they hit the public schools. There weren't a whole lot of universities in Florida at the time, other than that. And oh God, it was not good. It was not good. Julia, my friend Julia, who wrote stuff that turned me on to begin with, who was actually my first lesbian lover, went to Florida State. She was in Tallahassee at Florida State, and she was pretty open as a dyke because she really looked like Richard Stein. And the dean of women called her in one day, even though it hadn't been articulated. The dean of women called her in and told her she wasn't going to be allowed to stay there anymore because she posed too much of a danger to the girls in the dorm. And Julia went through the dorm and got all of the girls to sign a statement that she never had tried to bother them. And there were all the really ways to humiliate a person, but she wanted to stay in school. And she got this statement signed that she was okay, and the dean said, you know, I'm sorry, you just cannot stay here, but we'll allow you to transfer. We won't expel you. So she also transferred to the University of Miami, but they wouldn't allow her to stay in the dorms there either. They made her take an apartment off campus. And she was active in the Thespian Society, and they were putting on plays, and they were doing Alyssa Strata at one point. And there were a couple of gay guys she knew that were in the play, and they were at Julia's apartment, and they were rehearsing, and it was late. And she said to them, you know, it's late. You know, you can crash here. You don't have to go all the way home. And they got found out, and she got kicked out of school for having men in her room in the long run.
Oh, the ironies.
Yeah.
Multiple layers of irony.
And, of course, now it doesn't matter. You know, they got the co-ed dorms, and who cares what people
do.
Yeah. But yeah, she had men in her room. So out she went. Went to New York too. And became a very well-known writer and editor in lesbian circles for a while. Did a lot of really good collections and anthology, a lot of really good writing. And now she's in Lubbock, Texas, having had a major bad experience in the lesbian community, and just dropped out. Yeah, she's a good one. I hope we can get her to interview her for the project.
Sure. Well, thank you again. This has been really interesting.
Yeah, let's not talk anymore. We just
so much stuff.
Another whole story set.
Wow, this is great. And we need to continue this at a later date for sure. Thank you.
You just need to help.